efficient.
I know.
Ooh, I see it. I caught it.
Started without saying anything. It's
really? If the last 6 weeks are any indicator, she absolutely can.
And uncalled for.
No, you just don't like it because you were the one who was almost being caught speaking off guard.
Your European sensibilities.
I know, right? We missed all the bedtime topics that you guys, like, who tucks who into bed, who reads what, how, you know, super.
For the record,
stuff.
Andreas tucks me into bed.
But do look at what number episode we're on and have an off-color laugh about that.
I was way ahead of you.
Episode number 70?
No.
Yep, that's the joke. 70.
Oh, right. 69. Wow. Because 6 and the 60 and the 9 and the I got
hold
you.
On. Hold on. Seriously, Ben, tell me why 70 is funny.
Oh, my, it isn't. Webcam. It's because it's reversal of expectations.
Because 7, 8, 9? No? Okay. What? Anyway.
No, that's not how that works. That's not how any of this works.
Strike 301.
He's a 6 offender? I mean, which number jokes are we going with?
No. Anyway, okay. Welcome to the Dress the File podcast. A part exactly. of Broken Jars XYZ. And then that's all I remember off the intro.
That's all that is the intro.
Shit, I'm good.
Let's talk about news. None. Let's talk about how we swear a lot and spoil everything. Done. All right, intro done.
Awesome. This is great. We're, you guys have been trained wonderfully.
Yes. Yeah. So, what are we talking about in episode 69?
Briefcases.
No, episode 70. That's funny.
Now, briefcases is a little funnier with all the other jokes, but anyway.
Yes. We kind of started with it last time.
It's a very serious topic.
It is very serious. But that's next time.
Oh boy.
So we had kind of started on it last time, but we actually go through the short stories of briefcases. And chat about them. And that's the agenda.
Some again, because we couldn't wait when they came out the first time. But now we're kind of doing it like in the context of briefcases, because yay, we got a book.
Yeah, we did do some of them the day they came out, more or less. But we'll go through the other ones because we were all waiting for briefcases for a very long time to have them all in a nice little package.
I wasn't, but yeah.
I mean, some of them I hadn't heard. And some of them I was like, I gotta buy these anthologies. Oh, geez Louise.
That's what the library's for.
Yeah, but Denmark and English audiobooks. It's kind of eh.
We've had this talk, right? Like, you don't have libraries. What's the deal? Or you don't
libraries.
Get them?
It's just mostly Danish things. Mostly.
So they serve pastries.
And then
no.
The Danish dub isn't very good.
I mean, it's not even. It's not even. There's not even a Danish like paperback version.
Not dubs.
There's not even a Danish book of Dresden Files. It's only in Inglando.
Well, I feel like there's a niche market you could be satisfying for some extra cash.
Or protest. I mean, seriously.
Totally off topic. Looking at Justin when he talks, I'm just reminded I'm the only person with glasses now, and it's not fair.
Oh.
You should put on your glasses again.
You should use some of that universal health care you've got and get that fixed.
I don't think that covers LASIK. LASIK.
Does it cover contacts?
No. Pay for your own glasses.
So this is getting off topic. So am I hitting that again? So we're going to talk about Even Hand when the director... This is just getting worse anyway. We're going to talk about Even Hand and Bombshells because the director didn't think we did them justice.
Well, because I remember it was like we basically only had half the conversation of them because we're talking about like, oh, yeah, that was really cool. And that was kind of fun. And then there's a whole bunch of other things when we had to end.
Should we do the bullet points?
Podcast in a nutshell?
Marcone, Guard, and Hendrix are badasses. They're prepared for a magical attack because, you know, maybe Dresden goes crazy one day and signs up with, you know, the bad guys.
Or just takes out Marcone because he doesn't like him.
They have like a hallway of landmines. And then when you get there, they've got a magical bullet that pierces the shield. Spoiler alert. They fight one of the Fomor. Was there anything else in Even Hand that we missed? I mean, seriously, I am underselling this. Don't get me wrong. Like,
yeah.
Seeing Marcone and Hendrix and Guard be total badasses while fighting this guy is fun.
We see Justine kind of in her devious mode, too, right?
True. Yeah.
That's another great little
there being the damsel that causes things to happen.
Which I also how long passes between Evenhand and
Bombshells?
No, how long passes between Evenhand and the which book is it? It's
I think Evenhand is after Aftermath, isn't it?
No, and it's not.
Well, hold on, it doesn't have to be because after changes is when
the reason why I know it's not because the bombs in the wall in book 11 is where they got that idea from. They got it from Macone.
Well, no, because it has the Fomor in it, right? That has to be post-changes.
Fomors were around before. They just
it's between Turncoat and Changes, because in Changes, Marcone talks about how someone's encroaching on his territory, which is the first real hint of the Fomor.
Hmm.
It is... I know it's before Book 11.
It takes that's place why they got it. It takes place between Turncoat and Changes.
Hmm.
So...
Oh, yeah, specifically between Love Hurts and Bigfoot on Campus. So it's actually before Bigfoot on Campus, before Changes. I looked it up just here.
Interesting.
I have to tell Jim he's wrong.
What? Hang on.
When you become a fan.
No, but clearly, the bombs in the wall in Book 11, which is Turncoat, right?
Yeah, that's
there's a part where there's landmines in the walls, right?
That was at Laris. Well, that was
At Laris, and they got that idea from Macone. Justine saw it at Macone's.
Ah, okay. I'm following you now because the only landmines in the walls that I remember was Skin Game. So
yeah, no, I mean it was at Laris. They have these like they have the bombs in the walls. Like it's just been made. You see it. They all got like plaster or something. I can't exactly right. remember. I just remember that it's referenced, and I was so sure that Evenhand was like where they got that idea, and that's why I thought it was before Turncoat.
Gotcha.
Because that makes so much sense. Like, Justine is, she sees it, and she's like, hey, listen, Lara, great idea. Bombs in the wall.
I think this next read-through, I'm definitely going to actually have to go with the whole as chronological instead of reading side jobs and everything after the fact, because that will probably add some context for stuff like Evenhand, because now I'm curious, like, Evenhand, it was a Fomor, right? It wasn't some other random whack job.
No, which it was definitely a Fomor frog person.
Which means they made a move before Changes, mm-hmm. which is a little interesting, so.
They were around.
They said that he was, that's what they discuss in Burger King, is how someone's encroaching on his territory briefly but incessantly, was the quote, if I remember correctly. And they had talked about how the Fomor were basically ready to mobilize immediately, but people had gone missing. Those minor towns were going missing in the weeks leading up.
Leading up to Changes.
Yeah, like in Aftermath, they already had several weeks of that they were doing this preliminary stuff.
Yeah, the Night of Bad Dreams, the moment that Harry killed Susan, the Fomor were moving in on Chicago, so they were clearly preparing for weeks.
Right. So
they helped out the Red Court with their assault with the poison gas. We found out in Bombshells mm-hmm. that during the war, so it is actually confirmed on the official timeline that it's pre-Changes, even pre-Love Hurts, that the first appearance of the Fomor in Evenhand is exactly this.
So. Okay. I hadn't really solidified that timeline in my mind. Like, I think there's a difference between mobilizing and what is happening in Evenhand, but it is a good point. I forgot about the whole Bombshells thing. They were implicated in the whole Battle of Sicily cleanup, right? That they were the ones that gassed the wardens, right? That's what we're talking about.
Part of the problem is that we hear about the Fomor. In the novels, we hear about it in terms of Harry thinks, oh, there's a power vacuum the Fomor fill in what the Red Court was doing.
Right.
But what was really happening behind the scenes was something he doesn't guess at in the novels specifically. So that's part of the difficulty understanding.
Right. Well, yeah, and you're right, because it basically we're told through Harry that the Red Court vacuum is why these guys decided to get uppity. But really what's going on is these guys have been backing up the Red Court the entire time. And so there's zero downtime between the Red Court disappearing, which, you know, by and large was probably largely unexpected, other than maybe the Black Court thought it would be a possibility. And then the Fomor just showing up and being like, hey, guess what? There's no 5-minute breaks. We're going to kick your ass now instead of them.
Not even less than zero. It's less than zero downtime. They were around well before.
Basically, the Fomors were the faction beneath the Red Court and like helping the Red Court. And the Red Court disappeared. They moved up. And then, you know, the fish in the ponds.
With Rashid's comments about how Harry has done nothing but kind of put his thumb in the eye of the big bad guys, I wonder if the Fomor, being involved maybe at the Nemesis level, have been involved with a lot of this stuff, even back to Stormfront. Is it Nemesis? Is it just they're all kind of the Black Council together?
Right, and it all kind of depends on how interconnected he's got the lore at this point, right? Because are the Fomor agents of the Sleeper? Are the Fomor agents of, you know, the actual old Fomorian gods? Are those two separate entities? You know, and so forth and so on. So it kind of depends, like, who is ultimately leading them and why and to what ends, you know, because it could be that the Fomor are basically, like, if we go from a Lovecraftian view, the Fomor may be, you know, like the deep ones out of the Shadow of Innsmouth, for example, where they are, you know, just warped critters from the outside for where that intersects with Dresden. Or they could be, you know, the Fomor of legend, for example, where there are these warped old pre-fairy creatures, you know, that basically are running around. And really, I think in Dresden, it's both, kind of, or at least potentially. So
I can't help but wonder, since assessments of it in the timeline that's managed by the fans, and it's like, it's on the wiki, that even hand is between Turncoat and Changes. I just can't help but feel like that like Jim misremembered or something when he wanted to place that story in the timeline, because it makes so much sense to me that Justine sees that whole bombs in the wall idea and then Lara puts it in her house. That they got that from Even Hand, but it takes place after Turncoat, where they see the whole bombs in the wall thing.
There you go. There's your next Q&A question. Chicken and the egg. Who came first?
Why couldn't it be the other way around?
Right. That's my idea. So,
no.
I mean, it's a good tactical idea either way.
Right.
And it's nothing to say that two entities.
If you think about it from a writer's perspective, it's like Chekhov's gun. Like, it just feels like Justine is put in this story and she sees that thing and then it's in Turncoat, which is like, oh, aha.
The thing that you should keep in mind. Go ahead.
They mentioned that Lara probably was hiring ex-Marines for her bodyguards. Guess what branch military Marcon and Hendrix were in?
Also fair. I like that point. But the other point I was going to say is we're getting stuck on which one of these copied the other, but it's not like this is their idea either. Mavra did this shit first in the book series, at least as far as we've seen. And you know, she didn't invent it either.
Were they in the wall? Yeah. Like, put in the wall?
Well, they were. It was
on
like
the wall.
Yeah, in the back of a closet, angled to bounce down a hallway. Like Mavra did more with one, whereas Marcone and Lara were just like, "What if we just set off the entire front of the building?" You know,
and plus Marcone using him in Skin Game, right?
Right, which is what I remember, because like the vault, you know, the vault airlock is like, don't sneeze, because. Like, that's why Dresden had to wear the manacles, right? So,
Well, but. As far as the story, I mean, you guys have talked about Even Hand before, right?
Right.
Yeah, so I really liked the story. Good story.
Yeah, no, it's...
The dialogue was great.
Right, it's definitely one of the better ones.
I really liked Jim reading Marco more than...
James Masters.
Like, for the people who listen to the audiobooks, I think he did a really good job.
It seemed a little one note to me. That's one of the ones I was a little disappointed in the reading of it, because it didn't seem to have a lot of range.
It's all kind of the same delivery.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was pretty. I thought I could tell who the different characters were. It's kind of like the same critique I feel like my roommate is giving me a lot when he's listening to the Dresden Files, or that he has only listened to the first couple of books. But still, he says he can't tell who's talking when Masters is doing voices. Because to an extent, I understand that what he means, because he's used to in other books, they change their voice a lot more. But I can tell who Masters is talking, like what point of view, because of the way he talks. Like he changes his cadence, his intonation. Right. I don't know what to say. Like they speak differently, even if they all kind of sound like Masters.
Right.
Yeah, but well, other professional voice actors, like they make their voice a lot lighter when they're talking from a. He doesn't really do that. He sounds a lot like Masters actually, no matter who he does. Sure. But I can still clearly tell who is who.
I guess I was thinking more of the performance, even within the same character, even within the same dialogue or the same monologue. It was kind of the same tone again and again. I don't know. It's just a slight thing, but I do appreciate that Jim kind of wanted to get in the action, so it's nice, kind of as a fan of Jim Butcher, to hear him do it though.
So the message at home, kids, is read the books, and then you can use whatever voice you want.
No, just listen to them because it's actually really great to listen to audiobooks too. And now, you can do something else while you do it, like go biking, sleep, shopping.
Now I want Marcone with the Mickey Mouse voice, like, "Hi, Marcone, ha ha."
So the guy who did day one did a great job. He also reads Monster Hunter International. Justin, this is your weekly reminder.
Bi-weekly
reminder.
Remind me last
Monster
week.
Hunter International. You will love it. Or listen to it. The audiobooks are great.
That's all right. Anyway, let's see. What's next?
Bombshells. Well,
because even-handed bombshells are very interconnected.
Right.
So we're going to go that one next.
Which, you know, Bombshells was another one of those that I thought was great because it's like, holy shit, the FOMOR are doing shit before, you know, during, and they're kind of badasses, and you get a little bit more of their technology, for lack of a better word, you know, their gadgets and gizmos, where it's like, hey, we've just got this bomb thingy. And I don't know. It was also fun to see, like, the women, you know, like, take charge, and, like, that's the whole point of, well, it's one of the points of the name of the book or of the story and everything like that, is that you have, so it was Molly, it was Justine, and it was Andy. Yes, thank you. I was going to say,
right?
Yeah. So, and come on. So I know I'm not doing this chronologically, but the scene where they like kick in Thomas's door is fantastic. So,
Oh boy, did you boys pick the wrong room or whatever it is he says?
Right.
So, a basic overview of Bombshells. It's in Molly's point of view, and she's very messed up after changes and ghost story. And yeah, trying to be normal and not always succeeding. And she basically is able to like live minorly with Butters, but not really staying there, just like popping in at random. It pisses Andy off. Also, she used Andy's razor, and that really pissed Andy off.
I don't get that.
Yeah, I was like, as a female, can you elaborate on that? Or, like, is that a thing? I don't know.
There is a lot of real estate that a woman might need to shave. So if you use a razor and it goes down, it gets a lot harder.
But
okay.
It's just so much to cover.
Like the whole body?
Legs, armpits, under the nose. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so we know what you're shaving. Thanks.
Not me. I don't shave nothing. What are you talking
about? Clearly.
You shave your nose. Why would you include nose in that? Like,
sometimes there's unsightly under nose hair for ladies.
So you shave your nose. Got it. Thank you.
I don't know.
So,
director, can you elaborate on that? Unsightly nose hair? Is that a thing you have?
No.
I mean, if you have hair where you don't want it to be, it is unsightly.
Yes. That's
simple.
All I mean.
Well, I guess that is the correct definition of unsightly.
Right, that's what I was thinking. I was like, it's pretty much what it says on the tin, right, Link? So, it takes place after ghost story, but I think importantly, she's still the Ragged Lady. And that's part of what kind of is pissing off Andy. Like, there's a lot that goes into it, right? But it's like Andy has a confrontation with her early on where it's like, what other kind of girlfriend would just let some random woman show up in whenever she wants to her boyfriend's house and use her razor, you know? And
she has a key to Butters' apartment.
Right.
So she just lets her in and whatever. And Andy is like, do you realize how much trust this is taking? Please stop pissing me off.
Right. And Molly, of course, is doing the whole, like, don't make a big deal about it, you know?
Because I was just saying, as me listening to that or reading that, the thought did not even occur to me that that would be a problem until Andy like brought it up. Where I was like, I guess I can see that. That like the whole another girl having a keys to her boyfriend's apartment.
I mean, I'm not sure if it's even just her boyfriend's apartment. I think Andy was living there at the time as well. That's why her razor was there. So there's someone having a key to my house. I would freak out.
Right. And also this isn't just female territoriality or anything. Andy's an alpha. She knows about the game. You're coming in and out, bringing God knows what with you. You know, like I'm sure there's multiple levels that go into this, which is, you know, part of what's fun about Bombshells is like Harry's pretty much a one-dimensional character in a lot of ways. Like he's going to show up, he's going to get angry, somebody's going to get smushed, you know, whatever. Whereas Bombshells was a little bit of that, but it was a little bit of subtlety. And, you know, like they go in a disguise, you know, Harry's worn a disguise like twice. And one of them was him dressing up as a cheesy vampire, you know? So, it's just fun to see the,
there was this other time where he was, I mean, that's what you're thinking about. He was disguised as, you know, stuntman on a porn set.
True. That was a joke, though. He was the administrative assistant, and he technically was the administrative assistant, so...
Production assistant.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Well, the vampire was a joke, too. There's nobody there who didn't know who he was.
Right. It was not a disguise.
Well, like, James Bond is a disguise. I didn't say it was a good one, like...
It's a little hard to be a good disguise when you give your name away.
Right. So...
Back to Bombshells.
Yeah, past the territoriality and everything, like, Leah is the one that reaches out to her, right? Or...
So, Justine shows up to Butters' apartment saying Thomas has been kidnapped and they need to find him.
Right.
And then Molly goes and does her magic finding thing, which was great because the way she described how different she does it from Harry, like, he will just basically trial by fire figure it out. Like, it says this way, I'm going to walk 10 feet and then do it again. She does it with Trigg. She uses her brain. It was great.
So nice. It's so wonderful. Well,
no, Harry doesn't necessarily say, go 10 feet this way and then do the spell again. He has a thing that like pulls him in a direction.
Well, like he has like a compass needle type thing, and then he's trying to drive around town, figuring out where it's going to take him to go. And she's just like, okay, it's going this way from this point. I'm going to walk a standard distance this way, do it again, and figure out where the triangle is going to be.
You know, the difference here, I think, is almost the difference between a... maybe a bad example, but a Batman and a Batgirl, like in the kind of classic in our incarnation, you have Batgirl that's very much more emphasizing the detective aspect, the intellectual aspect, where Batman can also just go in and punch a guy. He's the world's greatest detective, but he can slug it out. Whereas there is that emphasis on a slyer kind of character moment, which I think is great for Molly. I absolutely agree.
Right.
All right, and then when she finds the building that the, oh fuck, what are they called?
The Svartalfheim.
Svartalfheim.
Svartalf, yeah.
I had to find the word in my head, sorry. So the Svartalfs had Thomas, and they had the building, and she's looking at it.
Oh boy, did they have him.
Mm-hmm. Leah then shows up and kind of gives a basic background of, like, it's going to be weird and maybe a little raunchy. You're going to have to get him out somehow. But she builds up as it's a real big thing, and then they have to go be pretty because Svartalfs are very attracted to pretty things, and that's why they get all dressed up.
I'm surprised Jim Butcher didn't catch flack for some sort of sexist thing there. Not that I think so. Just that, you know, that seems like something sensitive people would get all... Well, gosh darn, I'll never. I don't know. Let's ask the other Alex.
he's gotten pegged for that in other other instances.
Yeah, I know. It's.
I mean, to be fair, like the Svart Elves, like they're still fairies, right? And fairies use that type of shit as a weapon as much as anything. So I'm sure there's a whole lot of other stuff going on there too. But I forget, because there was a reason given in Bombshells, wasn't there? Because, like, I mean, they're kind of like, you know, the dwarves anywhere, where they're the master craftsmen of the Dresden Files. But
yeah, they like pretty things. So they that's the context of the thing with Freya, of why they stole her necklace and why she needed to do that to get it back, is because they were attracted to how beautiful that she is. And that's what their possession is about.
Right. Okay.
That actually can't be on purpose, that he's like deliberately. Has there been? There hasn't been dwarves yet. Has he been deliberately walking? What's his plan with dwarves?
Are Swart Elves not dwarves?
No, I know. So then what's his plan? No, Swart Elves are dark elves. They are elves.
It does say elf, yeah. Dark.
So I'm just wondering what his plans is with the dwarves.
They kind of seem like they're trying to take place of some amount of dwarves.
They seem to be filling the
craftsman aspect. Craftsman. But they did that in the lore too, to some degree.
I think part of it is that, yeah, dwarves are. I mean, the dwarves that we're thinking of are largely like a invention of Tolkien, right? Yeah. So Butcher's been a whole lot more specific. Like, we haven't run across any elves or orcs either. But we have run across the actual specific races that are there. Like, you know, we've got our trolls, we've got our, you know, brownies and things like that. Are there specific?
Yeah, they're not like important, but they were shooting off arrows in small favor.
I think actually that if you're talking about Svart Elves versus dwarves, I don't think that in Norse mythology there's a difference. I think Svart Elves are dwarves, as we call them, as we think of them.
Yes and no. Yes, they are very much dwarves the way we think of them, but there are also dwarves in Norse mythology besides Svart Elves.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking at...
If you say so.
I'm going to trust the you know, Viking guy, so I don't know.
Wait, I'm the Viking guy.
He's literally...
Literally from the north.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
I'm just not finding anything in the Wikipedia entry. I know it's just Wikipedia, but there's mentions of Svart Elves and Svart Elfheim on the dwarf mythology page on Wikipedia. So there
but they are very much the way we think about dwarves is what, like, Svart Elves, and that's like kind of what King David, classic dwarf. I just think that there are folklore about dwarves as well, not just Norse, I think, probably somewhere else, but I wouldn't know about that. But I'm just wondering, surely he has like some sort of plan at some point for not that they would act like we'd think dwarves should, like Tolkien dwarves, but I'm thinking, don't you think he's going to include dwarves at some point?
Well, they're going to build the gauntlet, and then they're going to create Stormbreaker, so that's where we're going to see the dwarves finally.
I mean, but, okay.
That was the same dwarf in Bombshells, wasn't it, Etri? That Peter Dinklage was?
Spoiler alert, Avengers, but it's been out for a while now. But how hilarious was it that the dwarf was huge?
Right. The dwarf was a dwarf and you...
Played by a dwarf, yeah.
Right.
A little person.
Played by an actual dwarf. I thought it was very meta.
Wonderful. Anyways.
Yeah. Director, you'd have to, you know, watch a movie at some point. So,
I just don't like Avengers.
15. You know,
not like comic
just
books.
Un-American, leave her alone.
Yeah, right.
When the Danish man is more American than the director of your podcast.
Oof, yeah, that's so. Anyway,
yeah, he's on the universal healthcare. Blah, 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 blah.
So, Bombshells, part of what's going on though is delegations, right? So, that's part of why the Fomor were there, to make a pact with the Svart Elves before everything else goes on. So
yes, the Fomor and the Svart Elves were going to sign a pact at midnight on that day that they had taken Thomas, and that's why there was a party. And the whole devious plan was that once they sign, and then they have to be on each other's side, the Fomor was the brother of the guy that they killed in Even Hand, and Marcone was there and involved anyway, and he was going to kill everybody, and then the Svartels would also be implicated in the war.
Gotcha. And so, I mean, I keep pulling back to this because I remember it being a bigger part. We haven't talked about it a whole lot, but like Leah also came to Molly, right? Because she had one of those A-B plots like Dresden does, where like Dresden's like, oh, I've got two jobs. Oh my God, how am I going to do both jobs? Turns out it's the same job. Whereas Molly was like, Leah needed to make Thomas, sure.
Go stop the Fomor. Like they happen to be the same thing.
Right.
But you didn't quite know that, even though they're both at the same place. And then all the girls get really dressed up, and Andy's super excited, and he's talking about shoes a whole bunch, and they go to a party. Yeah. Then they go find, like, the down area of the building and kind of figure out where Thomas is, and then they figure out where the Fomor dude is, and then he has a gigantic shell, which turns out to be a bomb. And then they fight, and Thomas has fun.
Right. Well, I mean, Thomas had fun, then he fought, then it was fun.
You think he doesn't enjoy fighting?
That's what I'm saying. Like, different kinds of fun, though, for sure.
Yeah. No, just Thomas having fun.
Right.
There are times. I think he finds it a little passe every once in a while, but there are times when he enjoys a good fight. He was he did sign up for the Wild Hunt for one night, and he's got it in him.
Mm-hmm.
Another really satisfying aspect of that fight, I think, was, like we were saying about Molly, how she used misdirection on a pretty extended way in that climax, where it was her and Andy versus the big bad. Is it Listens?
Listen.
Or was it just the Lord?
No S.
Oh, yeah, Listen. Main thug.
I was actually just looking this up because I couldn't let it go. I think I might have mixed up some stories so that they're like, where they're called in one story they might be called dwarves, and another they're called like Svartalfar or similar. But it seems they are basically like synonymous with each other.
That's what I thought. Is
an older word, probably.
Makes sense.
In any case,
So tell us more about this misdirection that Molly did.
Well, yeah. So she throws her voice in various ways. And has to very slightly give the guy a little hints about where she is, but not all the way. So it has to be that very delicate working that really plays to her strengths, or at least she made the situation play to her strengths. So rather than be I threw everything I had, and there was a lot of fire, and then I collapsed from exhaustion, and I woke up a day later. So that kind of pattern that you see in Harry's escapades, you have this slyer working where she's running around under the veil, throwing her voice out from various directions, making the guy send his fire up to the ceiling and so on. And so tire the guy out by having him attack where she isn't.
Gotcha.
She also did the small like number change on the door, which is why they broke into Thomas's room, and she was able to let him be the literal muscle while she dealt with other things.
Yeah, using the sorceress talents in the D&D campaign like Molly does with that is entirely the fun of a magical character for me. So it's wonderful to see that in this story.
These Fomor people are really weird, though. Like, listen, he shows up and he kills the bodyguard at the door, and then he disturbs the Fomor guy that says he didn't want to be disturbed and has the person who allowed me to be disturbed been killed, and he says yes. Weird situation.
Well, it's one of those I think Listen did a bad thing and then used it to his advantage, you know, where it's, you know, it's just like, it's chaotic evil. Like, you know, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do a bad thing, and then somebody's going to have to die, but I'm going to make sure it's a subordinate. And, you know, I'm sure the head Fulmore guy kind of knows that, too. Like, Listen's my trusted lieutenant. He wouldn't fuck up like this, so it's got to be that piss ant's fault. Good thing he's already dead. And let that be a lesson to you guys, you know. So.
Did I hear chaotic evil? Are we back to talking about alignments?
Yeah,
like, no. Yeah, we're going to do alignments part 7.
Lawful evil. Next.
I think the kettle's going off. I'll see you guys later.
Well, the chaotic evil is the infighting, you know, for sure, is what I'm thinking. You know, where it's just like the Fomor definitely, I mean, they've got a power structure, but it's definitely a little bit more backstabby. And definitely the fairies.
You know, it's white courtish and fairyish. And probably all, I mean, let's face it, all the Nate, even the friggin' wizards are backstabbers. Everybody's trying to get a leg up on everybody else, even and especially your best friend, because your best friend's the one closest to you that could just as easily turn. So why not have a leg up on them?
Damn, Jacob, who hurt you?
Yeah, I don't follow you all the way, but I see some of what you're saying, because it's like, I think I started from Dresden's side where that doesn't really happen that much. So,
well, he's also, you know, not, he's irrational with that kind of trusting of people, and everyone in his circle is a valued, and oh my God, I would never. But I mean, I imagine in a practical sense, if he ever sat down, he could, without much difficulty, have that Batman scenario, you know, where Batman comes up with a contingency plan for all the Justice League members. Harry could do that and not really break too much of a sweat about it, considering what's going on.
I think he could now. Mm-hmm. And when he tried to do that with potions early on, it always ended up ways he didn't expect. He kind of made the best of it.
But now with a daughter and with the scope of what's going on more, he could do that.
And I think he already has in Skin Game. That's the big reveal, right? With Goodman Gray.
Well, seeing him be sneaky with people, but specifically, like, imagine him having a plan to take out every member of the senior council. I don't think we're there yet. I think he's got the personality. He's getting that kind of devious, but he's definitely not there yet. No. So,
well, because no, he doesn't know what they have.
Right. I mean, and yay, peace talks. Woo! All right. So,
I mean, the scene I'm most looking forward to in Peace Talk is Dresden, Maggie, Thomas, and McCoy just sitting around dinner table, eating like a family.
And then Justine, because
yeah. What dream scenario are you living in?
And they're just having a good time, and it's nice. They have good life.
And there's a very small if Ebenezer actually doesn't know who or what Thomas is already.
He's going. Confirmed. He doesn't.
Butcher confirmed it.
I know, but he also had an earlier word of Jim's where he said he knows far too much about Thomas and all that. I don't think he decided yet.
Okay, so to borrow one of my favorite lines from Lucky Number 11, I'm a world-class assassin, fuckhead. It's my job to know. Like, he's a senior council-level wizard. The Black Staff. I think, regardless of what Jim says, I think it's diminishingly likely that he doesn't fucking have any idea.
He knows where his daughter was for all those years. Possible.
Yeah. Sure. Right. Yeah. That's the other thing. Like, he's already seen it happen with Maggie, and he had no idea how many children she had and with whom and where and blah, blah, blah. Like, no.
You know, there was that point where maybe Lucio wasn't a captain of the wardens yet, but Lucio hadn't known where Margaret Le Fay was when Thomas
Wraith. No, Margaret's not her kid.
But right. McCoy was at a dinner party with the fucking White King and his daughter.
And Ariana.
And now there's this White Court vampire who's always running around with Harry and living with him.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. And, you know, Jim has a way of surprising me every time, but I feel like it would be a disservice to McCoy's character for him to not know. Let's put it that way.
Especially when he puts so much lip service to Harry. You can't. He's a vampire. You can't this, that. Like, that, to him, that's not Margaret's son. That's the White King's son.
Sure. Yeah. Anything else from Bombshells?
Well, this is literally how she gets her apartment. Because she was so grateful for the fact that she caught and stopped the Fomor before they, like, killed everyone and dishonored the Svartels, that this is how she got her awesome apartment.
Which is big importance, because
as
soon as we were like, oh yeah, I got it from helping the Svartels, it's like, whoa, I want to know that story. And then
it's gigantic.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
And it's fantastic. It's wonderful.
It's probably bigger on the inside because Svartelf magic, so
Yeah, whatever. It's like she has a gigantic kitchen, like lots of rooms, and probably several bathrooms, and like an in-home gym. It's like,
it's guarded by like
the hallway and stuff. We've seen bombshells. Is that basically where she moves in?
I didn't think so, because I thought the place they were at in Bombshells was like a mansion, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But it's like a weird postmodern building or something.
I thought it was like a business building. I don't remember. Now I'd have to go back and search for that description. It could be the same building, but I don't think it was the same hallway because she had an outdoor exit.
Gotcha.
And a place to park her car in Chicago.
Woo!
One person in the entire story who doesn't need an apartment is Molly, because she never stays anywhere. She's the most bohemian of all the people. Well, she would be happy with a hammock out in the park.
Well, wasn't the whole point of her like getting a base like that was until she turned into
Yes, but I mean, think about all the things. Every time she gets a major magical anything, she no home. She gets talent. She leaves, the car.
No power. She gotta go sleep.
She gets her own apartment. She becomes the Winter Lady, and now she's chilling out under the polar ice cap. She doesn't.
It did take a little bit of time, and like this is the place also that like she was preparing for Harry to come back, because at the very end of the story is when she figures out that Leah was hinting Harry's alive.
Right, and I thought it's been said and or at least implied that. Like Harry's living in her apartment now that she's the Winter Lady. So
so she
doesn't need the apartment. It was just another way for Jim to get Harry back on his feet, I guess. I don't know, something like that. But yeah. Bless you.
Thank you. Okay. Next would be probably the Bigfoot trilogy.
Super fun. So
I
like how they progressed, between each one. Like you can see like, hey, wait, Harry's paying attention and he's learning shit, So
yeah. I guess if anyone wants to start with like a synopsis for B is for Bigfoot.
That's the first one, right?
Yes. Yeah. The first one in order.
I just listened to this one again on the road trip.
Hey, someone who does work. Awesome.
Hey,
I listened to it like a month ago.
Yeah, I incidentally listened to it recently.
Dresden gets this mysterious call out in the forest. He waits an hour. He finds Bigfoot. Bigfoot's there. He manages to scrounge up some stuff for them to eat. Bigfoot says, hey, I got my kid. My kid's in trouble. Could you go and help him? So Dresden heads on down to the school where his kid is, and his kid's being picked on by some twins.
Swart elves again.
And the Swart elves, the little kid Swart elves, are being enabled and defended, and basically by a big bad daddy, Uncle Swart Elf, who's not really related, but is just protecting them, and prevents Dresden from acting directly to keep. This nerdy little Bigfoot child from being bullied.
Say little.
That's true. He's the biggest one.
Yeah, he's like what, fourth grade and 6.5 feet tall.
Yeah, he's basically as tall as Harry, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
he was almost little for a Bigfoot. He was like 14.
Little for a Bigfoot. You want this?
I thought he was younger than that because
in the first one he's not a teenager yet.
Yeah, because in the second one he's a teenager.
Oh yeah, I was. Wow. Either way, he wasn't a fourth grader.
About that though, he's elementary school, wasn't he?
I thought so. Let me. I will click
something
on it, and I will read a little bit of the story as you keep talking.
Yeah. So that's the dilemma. That's the conflict, and Harry has to figure out how to help this kid without getting crushed by the big bad Swart Elf, who could really own Harry pretty easily if Harry directly gets involved. And there's some good bits of menace there. He's undercover as a janitor, and he gets paid in a gigantic gold nugget by the end.
So, well, and a second one, I thought, because he threw him one initially. So one importantly here, which I didn't realize until I just looked, this takes place between Full Moon and Grave Peril. So it's baby Harry. And I call that out because, again, these stories were written way after the fact. And I read them way after the fact, obviously. And so, like, he deals with a Svartalf. And at one point, they have a little, you know, showdown where it gives him the ultimatum. It's like, if you interfere, I will kill you. And Harry's like, you know what? You probably would, you know. And yeah. I'm like, that's pretty crazy. This dude must be super powerful. But no, he's dealing with, like, baby Harry. So...
Yeah, right. And right. Harry didn't solve the issue by beating someone. He solved it by being clever and letting someone else beat someone.
Right. So he basically did the dad thing, right? He told the kid how to deal with bullies, and the kid dealt with bullies, because the whole thing was the Svartalfs are picking on him because they know he's supernatural, and as, you know, Uncle Svartalf called him, he's a whetstone. He's there for the kids to sharpen their instincts. And so so that's kind of what was going on. And then Harry's just like, look, if you want them to leave you alone, do this thing, because, you know, they're not just going to hurt you. So consider, you're not standing up for yourself. You're standing up for everybody else, you know, type of thing. So, and then he tells that to the Svartalf afterwards as well. You know, it's just that he's like, why would I not take retribution on baby Bigfoot? And it's like, well, consider that what he did was doing your kids a favor, because someday they're going to bite off more than they could chew, and something out there is going to kill them instead of just rough them up a little bit, like just happened, you know? So you learned the lesson, and you learned it early before somebody got maimed or dead.
Right.
So,
which was a clever enough answer for the Svartalf, who appreciate it, and true enough that he didn't have to, you know, beat up Harry. Which was nice.
Right. Which, you know, it is fun to see Harry resolve a thing that doesn't involve, like, blowing out windows and doors off of hinges and stuff, for sure.
Or schools burning down. And yeah,
doesn't. I mean, to be fair, he basically doesn't even use any magic in the story, right? Like, I think he used his sight at one point to figure out that the dude was a Svartalf. But other than that, he basically.
The most thing that he did was dress up as a janitor.
Right.
They eat disguise.
Right.
There it is. Oh, yeah.
See, but it's a good little intro into what he's not going to be able to do for Maggie, since she's going to be going to the same school with the same hands-off policy. The kids duke it out themselves.
Story. Yeah, this is...
It is a different one, yeah.
So, B is for Bigfoot says it takes place in Madison Academy. But yeah, I was thinking Bigfoot. Takes place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's smagged.
Yeah, which is great, because he totally makes that crack in this one. So Teenage Werewolf, basically, it's several years later. This one takes place around Deadbeat.
Bigfoot. So, teenage Bigfoot.
Isn't that what I said?
I was a teenage Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, I said teenage whatever. Werewolf. That's okay.
Bigfoot, okay, well, werewolf. Okay. So Freudian slip, because that's where it's ripped off from. So,
right.
But this time, Erwin, baby Bigfoot, is a teenager and he's sick, which is problematic because big-footed people don't big get feet. Sick. I know, right? I was just trying to conjugate. But anyway, so they don't get sick because the forest people have a super awesome life aura, and that's just not what happens. So everybody freaks out because it's a thing that's happening. Harry goes in, you're right, dude, he's got loads of disguises. So he goes in disguised again as a lawyer this time, because...
That was a private investigator, because he can't pull off lawyer, but he's like, the mother hired me because she is concerned. Do give me access to the child or I will make her worried.
Right.
Well, and that, then wasn't that wasn't much of a disguise. That was just, he actually did have the paperwork. He actually did.
Yeah, which was the best to kind of disguise.
But that is... Also,
he was disguised as somebody with authority and, like, actually an adult.
I'll allow it because Ben doesn't like it. It's a disguise.
It just as a note that we didn't describe this kid's mother. Like, she is probably larger than Charity and very, very intimidating if she wants to be.
Right.
Right. I mean, she's like a mountaineering, you know,
archaeologist.
Woman. Like, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Who survives a winter. Yeah, no, she's fed. She's fed and taken care of. But she survives a winter in the wilderness.
With Bigfoot.
Stranded.
Yeah,
stranded. Because that's how that happens. So, so she's off in some remote thing. So Papa Bigfoot reaches out to Harry, gives him power of attorney, sends him to go check the kid. They do the typical administrative bullshit, like, no, I don't want you to see the kid, partially because dude's in on the take in this case. So he's trying to just shoo Harry away and play the administrator. No, it's fine. Everything's going to be fine. The nurse is kind of fun because she doesn't take bullshit from Dresden, but she wants to help Erwin, and she's willing to help Dresden a little bit to make that happen. And then Harry gets to throw down with the guards a little bit, which was also kind of fun because then that makes everybody freak out. And Harry realizes that, you know, there is actual black magic going on here. So when he figures out the spell and everything, tracks it down to its source, surprise, it's the school administrator, who's also a dickbag. But extra, extra surprise, my favorite part of the twist was that the dude is, he's one of the, shit.
He's an ex-Venatori.
Yeah, Venatori, thank you. I could only remember the second half of the name.
Stupidest reason for black magic yet.
Yes.
Which is the great thing about it.
Yes, because he wants to grow hair.
Yes, vanity is a very powerful force. And he's going bald. He sees that Erwin at age like 14 is covered in hair. He's like, I'm going to steal some of that and look pretty.
Right. And it's great because I think my favorite part is like, Harry is like, you know, I can fucking kill you for this, right? And dude's like, please don't. And Harry's like, never again. And then that's like the end of it. You know, I'm just like, it's so like anticlimactic in a way too, because you've already had the throwdown with the guards, and then Harry doesn't even like hurt the guy or anything.
Name is Dr. Fabio.
Right.
That wasn't a hint right at the beginning, right?
Oh, and it's even better. Okay, so the whole him making fun of it, right, is so he's at St. Mark's Academy for the gifted and talented, right? Or the gifted. Yeah, it is gifted and talented. Yeah. So, and he's like, shouldn't it be like resourceful and talented? You know, it'd be smart instead of smaggot. And he's like, that doesn't even make sense. Because I forget, he does hit the guy. He's like, look, I'll even show you how to work it. He's like, smaggot, and like hits the guy, you know. because just kind of demonstrating that it's like, you don't even need a real word to use magic. You just do the thing, so... But I like how that was made a joke, and I didn't even fully catch on until, you know, we were talking about the young adult series that's coming out, you know, because she's going to go to the same thing, and everybody keeps hearing the story from Butcher where it's like, oh yeah, she's going to go to that, and Dresden's going to make jokes about it all the time. And it's like, he already made the joke. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, we already know the school.
I'll give it a pass, because repeated dad jokes that aren't even funny anymore is a dad joke thing. So I'm fine with it.
A dad joke to itself.
A dad joke to itself. Exactly right.
Right.
And the next one in the Bigfoot trilogy is Bigfoot on campus of when he's in college and a football player, like you could imagine.
Right. And is awesome for its own thing. This one's turncoat and changes again. A lot of stuff happened there, apparently.
Yeah, apparently. Like, this is definitely, Harry is in the know. It had to happen after the White Knight, because he saw a particular White Court vampire there that comes up in this one. We'll explain that one in a minute.
True. Yeah. Does someone else want to do this one? Okay. So my favorite part about this one.
Oh, you can't see me. I was shaking my head.
Oh, yeah. You
heard the rattling. Off, dude.
So I think my favorite part of this one is how it takes the entire story takes place after the story, where basically the whole narrative here is that he's telling the campus cop what happened for all the crazy shit that happens. So Harry's doing like a noir story to the cop as it goes on. And like, you could just totally visualize him being in the interrogation room or wherever while this is going on. And it's fantastic. Yeah. And so they have these little side bust moments, like you would get out of like Princess Bride and whatever, where the cop's like, hey, what about this? He's like, do you fucking want to know the story or not? You know? So
it's like, but how did the car end up in the ceiling? It's like, do you just listen?
Right.
Yeah, that was, it's a nice little touch that way. It's like, I, those things can be fun because, okay, you know, the main character gets out alive, but what about everyone else?
Right. Right. So, so in this one, Papa Bigfoot again, you know, reaches out to Harry. You, if you haven't read the stories, definitely read the stories, because there are some fun little tidbits there. Like, I think it's the first or second one, you know, Harry's like, how do you even call me? Like, your hands are too big for phones. He's like, oh, well, we've got people on the reservation help us with that. And every time, you know, Papa Bigfoot's like, so got any smokes? You know, it's like, one of my favorite lines out of those stories. But anyway, so he calls him. His son's in trouble again, as you might imagine. This time he's in college, a football player. Dresden is on campus. He's looking. Oh,
the payment isn't a negative gold this time. It is, you have to meet your kid, because Erwin has never met his dad yet.
Right. He's like,
if I help him, you have to see him, because this is wrong. That's Dresden being a forceful dad even before he knew he was a dad.
And then right. not taking his own advice later.
Mm-hmm. You should have met Papa Bigfoot again after that. It's like, hey, go meet your kid. Have fun with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even more than that, this time around, though, doesn't he actually offer to wire the retainer? So he's, like, upped his game anyway. I thought, like, he stopped doing the gold and, like, actually was doing proper banking at one point. So.
No, it's a gold nugget.
This one.
I mean, it's a gold nugget about as big as a ping pong ball.
Yeah, the second one was a little bigger, if I remember correctly.
Gotcha.
And okay. Then, I don't know.
So he goes on campus. He's looking for Erwin, sees him on the field, but he bumps into somebody first, and turns out that she is his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So this cute little Southern accent. I can't remember too much. I think she was just a cute little blonde girl, right? Basically. So
yeah, just.
Yeah, well, dun, I mean, we're going to get to that. So, so you know, she's there and she's kind of flirting it up with Dresden a little bit. And then she's like, oh, I'm going to have to collect you. And as everything is kind of like coming to a head and whatnot, Erwin gets cut from practice. You're welcome. I'm doing some of these double entendres on purpose, just a couple. But so they get cut from practice. He hops the fence, comes over and says, hey, what's up? That's when they realize it's like, oh, you are waiting for somebody on the field. You're waiting for Erwin. Okay, plot thickens. So
and what he means by collecting is just go to dinner and have a nice time. It's a very banal, friendly, nice time, and nothing to do with the fact that she is a White Court vampire and doesn't know it.
Spoilers.
She's a White Court vampire and doesn't know it.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So they go to dinner, and Erwin, of course, knows who Harry is at this point because he's showed up out of nowhere twice before in his life. And you know, they do their dinner thing. Yeah, she just likes to hang out with people, get stories, and their picture, I think, was part of it. And then at one point, like, she goes to the bathroom, and then Erwin's like, okay, cut the crap, what the fuck's going on? And Harry's like, well, I don't know yet, but as soon as I know, I'll let you know. And, you know, I'm not here to try and, like, muck stuff up. I'm just here because I was hired and, you know, your dad and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. And at this point, Erwin gets pissed off. Is like, he doesn't get to interfere with my life if I've never even seen him. Yeah.
Right.
Which is the correct response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally understandable. Here, I'm having trouble picking up the next thread. So does anybody remember? Because I can remember the climax mostly. But
right.
So after the dinner, Harry and the girl, Connie, they go walking because Erwin wanted to go home differently. And they start talking. And Connie is describing how in love she is with him. And you realize, like, she really doesn't know. And she really cares about him. And then her dad shows up.
Right.
And
okay.
It's like, stay away from my child. I will kill you. It's like, oh yeah, you were at the deeps.
Right. Like front row left. Right. So yeah. So daddy's there. He was in the deeps in White Knight, managed to escape. And you know, he was pretty much front, as we said. And then, basically, like, Connie goes with him. Right. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, dude is basically setting it up. Like, Erwin was supposed to be her first kill, and Daddy Vampire is stupid and doesn't realize what's actually going on.
Yeah.
You know,
the thing was, is that he was her first, but the giant chunk that she took out of him didn't kill him. they were just really tired and didn't know what was going on. And then they had a relationship.
Right. And he still wants her, he still wants Erwin to be her first kill, so he's going to orchestrate all that jazz. Now, the part where I get a little bit confused on this, and maybe while we're discussing this, it'll come out and whatnot, is that if she's truly in love with him and they do the thing, she shouldn't be a White Core vampire anymore. So somebody's lying.
Well, no. they didn't know each other until they hooked up at a party and then liked each other afterwards.
Yeah, so she wasn't in love when they did it.
Yeah, their first time makes sense. But every time after that, both of them recognize that they love each other. Why are they not killing each other?
Well, there's that too. Like that, because even, okay, so let's say you're right. At the party, it wasn't love yet, whatever, because they basically met because they got spin the bottle and wound up in the closet together or whatever.
Yeah,
But yeah, like certainly now, you know, with their ongoing relationship, and they talk about how I think she might be the one or whatever. In this case, like that should still be lethal to her in some way, you know, unless it's different because he's a Bigfoot.
Well, so, there's also
or the possibility. Half.
I mean, she, you know, I don't know that this is necessarily a prerequisite, but the fact that the Hunger didn't get a kill the first time, so she's not technically, I mean, yes, she is feeding on him, but she's not a White Court vampire in the same sense that any other White Court vampire is a White Court vampire, she up to the fact that she doesn't even know.
And she has no idea.
So the Hunger itself might not be developed enough to the point where it's going to be mortally injured by true love in the same way.
You'd have to, I think, invent some kind of reasoning, because I think it's clear from the text that she's supposed to be a full White Court vampire, but like you're saying, not in the same sense as everyone else. Because I think that's where the dilemma in the text is. If you make it so that, well, she's not a White Court vampire, well then, okay, then it's just the situation as with youngest Wraith, right?
Right. Because that's the thing. It's like, this is definitely far enough in Dresden knows about Inari. Like, that's not a mystery how that whole life cycle works. And yet, in this book, or in this story, it doesn't seem to play a role for whatever reason.
So, no, it is a short story.
Maybe it is.
And it's consistent with maybe the laws of magic, even though, of course, that's wizards and not supernatural. If killing somebody with magic changes you in such a way that you become kind of corrupted and dangerous, maybe that's the same mechanism that's operative in making the part of the White Court vampire that feeds on people, making that evil, right? Or making that kind of the monster that Thomas talks about, that Lara talks about, that all these White Court vampires talk about. Maybe it is the kill itself that makes that feeding, that hunger, actually bad. That creates the vampire to be the evil vampire rather than just, you know,
right. Her hunger is just doing a kind of a passive thing right now. It's not controlling her. It's not seeking her. You know, she's not falling to the floor every other day if she doesn't have... I mean, they're having a lot of sex, but she's not, you know, she's not dripping with desire to eat someone every 5 seconds.
Because otherwise, if she does love them and they do love each other and she's a White Court vampire, then she should eventually kill him, and or he should eventually kill her at least. But I don't think that's where he's going with this.
So I get part of what you're saying, but it still doesn't explain the fact that, like, love is the antithesis of the hunger. It's not merely a good and evil thing, because, you know, Thomas, case in point, Thomas wasn't feeding to be evil. He was feeding just enough to get by, and he still couldn't touch Justine without it burning him. Like, burning him.
That's later. He's already got a well-established life of, there were people before Justine, clearly.
Right.
I think the reason that the thing didn't die right away was that they weren't at all in love. It was just a kind of chance encounter.
Well, and I get that, but now they have an established relationship, and she's clearly not in, a white.
Well, they're not
vampire.
In love enough yet. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's like
it's possible too.
Thomas didn't get burnt by Justine until that sacrificial moment where they both of them
she gave herself
basically wanted to die for each other.
She loves him, and she admitted it. He took himself away from her because he loved her, and he admitted it. It's the fact that they both admitted it, I think, that
they both were willing to die for the other person.
Basically, symptom of the same thing. And it seems like the way Connie and Erwin talk about each other is like they probably already recognize that in each other.
So maybe someday he is going to kill her. Because that, if I
or
mean,
someday
if
they're going to have to include another sex partner.
Right. Dresden's going to be like, hey, my brother's got some advice for you kids. Like,
or maybe well,
after all
thing,
that, they kind of get into the know of what the whole deal is, right? Yeah. I mean, right. I think, or doesn't he tell Erwin or she tell Erwin? Some, you know, he finds out.
Well, and Erwin knows because he reads the Paranet, which is the fun tidbit for this book, too. He's like, I've been on the internet, some joke place called the Paranet.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he mentions the Paranet by name.
No, he did.
Yeah, he absolutely did.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Paranet, we missed it. We missed it. Okay, I have this great thing.
No, we're over. Story. We can't do it.
No. In the second Bigfoot story.
Bear the Broken Jars.
The paranormal investigator with the professor is named Gary. Is that the same Gary who is Gary?
I don't know Gary. Is
you are Gary.
Yeah, I can't follow this because I got stuck on your Gary. So what?
Okay. Other than myself being Gary, there is the Gary at the very beginning of the framing device or the very kind of the cold open of the second Bigfoot story. And he's there trying to find Bigfoot with the other two guys. He just happens to be named Gary. Is that the same guy who becomes Paranet Gary?
Boat it is now.
Gary. I mean, it probably could be because as far as that Gary, the particular Gary that we're talking about ever did, was just boats on Twitter.